This is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 8th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks so much for being here with us today. And we begin today along the southern border. Back in Washington, D.C., Congress is voting on a big spending deal today. But left out of that deal again is immigration, border security, and what to do about the nearly 700,000 undocumented young people avoiding deportation with the DACA program. Along the border, meanwhile, in southern Arizona, there is talk of a wall today and a history of tension.
Third time. So?
We're getting harassed.
Yep.
No, you're not.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
Everybody goes through.
No, we are getting harassed.
May I say hi to everybody that's in the vehicle?
No, we're U.S. citizens.
I'd like to be able to confirm that.
He just saw that we're U.S. citizens.
The same thing like you guys. We just don't have a green uniform.
So we're trying to do our job.
What you're hearing there is a confrontation between Tucson priest and U.S. citizen Abron Tadeo and a Border Patrol agent back in December of 2016. Tadeo was crossing back into the United States from Mexico with six relatives, including his 77-year-old mother, and ended up getting arrested.
Sir, step over here.
I'm going to open the door.
You're not going to open the door. What you're going to do is you're going to step over here, okay?
Don't touch me.
I'm going to arrest.
No. What the heck are you touching me for? Stop.
Tadeo was charged with assault after that incident. Those charges were dropped just this past December. Hundreds of thousands of people cross the U.S.-Mexico border every day without incident. But what you just heard is one example of encounters that can take place between U.S. agents and people crossing a border with Mexico that stretches nearly 2,000 miles. The U.S. Border Patrol apprehended 341,000 people along that border in 2017. Now, that's a 44% drop from the year before. But while the number of migrant crossings has dropped, the number of deaths increased in the past year from 398 to 412. So today, we want to go behind some of those statistics and get a sense of what life and encounters actually look like at the border. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a former Border Patrol agent who wrote about his experiences on the job. But first, a reporter whose beat is the border. Michelle Marisco is the senior editor on the Fronteras desk for KJZZ in Phoenix.
The legal traffic, which is people who live on both sides of the border, people who work on both sides of the border, a massive shipping industry, and that tallies up to several tens of thousands of legal crossing through ports of entry every single day. Between those ports of entry is an entirely different matter. There we have undocumented immigrants, and those numbers have been dropping, but they continue to try to cross the border illegally.
Well, Michelle, illegal crossings are down, apprehensions are down, but the overall number of migrants who've died making the journey hasn't dropped.
Yeah.
What's going on?
We still have about 1 to 2 people on average who die every single day trying to cross the border illegally.
Michelle, you visited a morgue in Arizona near the border that keeps the bodies of undocumented people, if they die, while making the journey across the border.
So we're here in the cooler. You can see that the remains to the right-hand side of the cooler in these white body bags are generally our undocumented border crosser remains. And since it's a small bag, it clearly doesn't contain an entire set of human remains and is likely skeletal remains.
This is Dr. Greg Hess. He is the Pima County Medical Examiner. His forensics team has done some incredible revolutionary work when it comes to DNA examination on bodies of people who are found out in the desert. So many of these bodies, like he describes, there are skeletal remains. They've been scavenged, and it's been a long time since that person was alive. Sometimes these numbers become politicized, you know, the number of people who die on the border. Some federal agencies like to try to keep that number down by saying, well, if we can't identify who that is, then we can't say it was an immigrant. Dr. Hess's office has been revolutionary in circling back on that argument and identifying that these people were indeed immigrants.
Meanwhile, Michelle, let's talk about the wall before we run. What's that debate like in Arizona? And when you go to the border there, what changes do you see in terms of anything new being built between Arizona and Mexico?
So, yeah, let's talk about the border wall. Here we already have two types of border infrastructure. We have what we call vehicle barriers. These are these X-shaped steel beam structures that exist for about a third of the Arizona's border with Mexico. And then we have these bollard style walls, which are bars, essentially almost like a jail cell. Right. And these exist in the urban areas around Nogales, Arizona, around south of Yuma, Arizona, and some of these other places. Between the two, roughly 70% or so of Arizona's border already has some sort of infrastructure. Most of this came about as a result of the bipartisan Secure Fence Act of 2006. Many miles of infrastructure were added as a result of that rule. Now what's being talked about is replacing a lot of that new infrastructure with, of course, these concrete and steel massive 30-foot high walls that are being tested out in San Diego.
And if you're a voter in Arizona, Michelle, your support for the wall, does it generally break down along the lines of whether you support President Trump or not?
Yes, absolutely. If people support the president's policies when it comes to immigration, then yes, the wall is very much in favor for some of these voters. People who are looking at the administration's efforts with immigration as something that's far more heavy-handed than we are accustomed to as a country, then yes, the wall makes no sense. Logistically, law enforcement officials here that are not the U.S. Border Patrol or not Homeland Security will tell you that the wall is going to have a minimal impact.
Michelle Marisco, senior editor on the Fronteras desk for KJZZ in Phoenix. Michelle, a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
The story of the southern U.S. border with Mexico was an everyday reality for Francisco Cantu. He grew up near the border, studied it in college, and then after school, joined the Border Patrol and returned as an agent to experience what life was like there firsthand.
I remember talking with this woman. Her husband was kind of watching us, and he saw that we had a connection. I remember him turning to me and saying, "Hey, man, you know, can you just bring us back to the border? Just be a brother." And in that moment, I was like, "No, this is my job. I can't do that." And it wasn't difficult for me to say that. And, you know, so I took him back to the station. I remember, you know, wishing them luck and like introducing myself to them and telling them my name and asking them for their name and then sort of sending them on their way and telling them to be safe. And then what still sticks with me about that interaction is that, you know, even like an hour after that, I remember sitting in my car and not being able to remember their names. And I think that like that's the first stage of dehumanization. I wouldn't have realized it at the time, but looking back on it, that was me normalizing violence and becoming numb.
I spoke with Francisco Cantu about his experiences as a Border Patrol agent. He writes about them in his new book, The Line Becomes a River. It's out this month.
I grew up in the Southwest, and then I went away to college. I kind of became obsessed with immigration and border issues. And so by the time I graduated, I knew that I wanted to come back to the Southwest. And I had like all of these questions about the border from all of this academic learning and, you know, a lot of the same questions that we're sort of grappling with today. And so, you know, I saw the Border Patrol as a way to, you know, get answers. And I also saw it as a way to, you know, get a sense for the border as a landscape and as, you know, a wild place. And so I was really, you know, looking to have an understanding of what the border feels like and what the sort of realities are day in and day out. And I didn't want to just be there on the weekend. I didn't just want to go there for day trip. I wanted to sort of understand what this place was like on, you know, the hottest day of the summer and then the coldest night of the winter. And that's really what led me to join.
We'll talk a little bit about the job while you were in it, the kinds of people you called colleagues, and really the day-to-day work, what it was really like on a Wednesday at 2 o'clock.
You know, one thing that a lot of people might not realize about the Border Patrol is that it's really like 80 to 90% kind of tedious boredom out in the middle of nowhere in the desert. You know, you're literally looking at dirt. You're watching the fence rust. But the other 10% of the time is you know, really unpredictable, really dynamic, possibly dangerous. But, you know, more than any of that, more than the drug bust or like car chases or any of that sort of exciting sounding stuff, what really stuck with me, the biggest impressions that I carry with me now looking back on it, were these sort of quiet human interactions that I had, you know, with the people that were crossing the border that I, you know, was bringing into the station. The thing that was impactful about those interactions was the way that they made a lot of these platitudes that you hear about the border very specific. So for example, you know, one of these things that we always hear about the border is like, oh, you know, there's good guys and there's bad guys. And you know, the good guys are just coming here looking for work. And you hear that so much that it's just this refrain that kind of means nothing. But, you know, I'll never forget bringing someone into the station, you know, apprehending him as part of a group. I remember putting his fingerprints into the computer and processing him for deportation. And, you know, he kind of looked around the room and sort of asked me, you know, while I'm waiting here, is there anything I can do? Can I take out the trash? Can I clean the cells? And I thought, you know, you don't understand. You just have to wait here. A bus is going to come, going to take you to the next place. And he says, no, I understand. I want to show you that I'm here to work. You know, having someone say that to you, standing right in front of you, I think it changes things. It makes it personal. And you know, nothing is more powerful than an individual story.
And it's individual stories that humanize others for us. And in reading your book, it's one of the main things you seem to have taken away from this experience, not viewing immigration or border security as kind of an abstract policy concept, but face-to-face with migrants, with people who want to work or are fleeing trouble back home or something like that.
I mean, what I think about when I hear our conversations about immigration and the border, it's impossible for me not to think of like all the glaring things that seem to be missing from that conversation. You know, there's this urge to simplify the border, to talk about it in these black and white terms, to say, oh, build a wall. When I think about the border, like I remember the people that I interacted with. And, you know, one thing that I'll never forget is like finding a dead body in the desert and, you know, being face to face with the two people that had accompanied this man on his journey, you know, these like young boys who are now just wondering what to do with the body of like their uncle. The fact that there are people dying out in the desert, that's not being talked about to the extent that I think we need to be talking about it. I mean, I think that's a humanitarian crisis, and it's one that's happening on our own soil. We're not acknowledging that in our conversation right now about border enforcement or immigration reform. And I think, you know, we have to move towards acknowledging those people, acknowledging their deaths, mourning their deaths, you know, naming their bodies. So many of these people are unidentified. And I think, you know, in general, looking at these numbers and these statistics as each being, you know, representative of an individual person.
There's a section in your book, Francisco, where you write, what you do as a border agent depends on what kind of agent you want to become. But it's true that we slash their bottles and drain the water into the dry earth. We dump their backpacks out. We step over them. You say, this is the kind of thing that Americans have recently seen in viral videos on social media, border agents slashing water bottles, pouring the water out. You say it also gave you nightmares afterward.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even if you as a Border Patrol agent don't participate in that, you know, I never participated in that, it doesn't absolve you of it, right? Because you're part of this larger structure. You know, I'm still sort of very preoccupied with to what extent we can separate the individual from the institution that they work for. I think that, you know, we have this policy that has really weaponized the landscape, right? We're pushing crossers away from the cities, away from these areas that are more regularly patrolled, into the most dangerous, rugged, inhospitable parts of our desert. And people are dying there. And we can't lose sight of that. So these humanitarian groups that are leaving water in the desert, you know, they're working to fill a deadly void that has been left open by our policy. I think that to criminalize that aid or to destroy that aid is totally unacceptable. I think that the Border Patrol needs to be held accountable for that. And I also think that while we must hold individuals accountable, we also can't lose focus on the larger structures that are at work and the institutions that put that person there, that trained and equipped them for their job.
Well, the president gave the State of the Union address, Francisco. He talked a lot about immigration. There are policy proposals on the table. People will debate those. But you also saw the message from the president. It goes back to the campaign. The subtext of that message seemed to be that undocumented immigrants are a threat to your safety if you're an American. These people are here to harm you. Here's an example of somebody whose child tragically was killed by an undocumented gang member. Sort of distilling a lot of immigration down to that. And I wonder how you digest that kind of messaging in this debate.
I think we're constantly being made to look at and talk about migrants in ways that are dehumanizing. And, you know, personally, I think that we should reject thinking and language that facilitates exclusion. I think we should resist labeling migrants as the other, no matter what kind of other that is. You know, labeling someone's existence as illegal, or, you know, conflating every border crosser with gang members, to regard like an entire person as somehow being unlawful, I think that sets us on the path towards intolerance. And so I'm as concerned about it as a lot of your listeners are, I'm sure.
Why did you finally leave?
Shortly after I started working for the Border Patrol, I would start to have these dreams or nightmares. And, you know, in the everyday course of my job, I think I had been conditioned to think of what I was doing as normal. I think I normalized a lot of the violent aspects of my job. But in these dreams, you know, I would come up on dead bodies, or people I had arrested and sent back would, you know, come back to me. I even had dreams where I was like chasing people and shooting them down. For years, I just ignored those dreams, but they didn't go away. I would also have these dreams that my teeth were falling out. And I remember going into a dental appointment like years after I had joined the Border Patrol, and the dentist, you know, told me that you grind your teeth in your sleep. Your teeth look terrible. And I was like, I've never had that problem before. What are you talking about? He said that I had, you know, worn through the enamel on my molars. And so that was like the first time that I was sort of confronted with a physical, real world manifestation of this, you know, creeping subconscious horror that I had, I think, been feeling about the job and that had been building up about the job. And so that was really the moment when I had to sort of sit up and look at myself and say, you know, something's wrong here. Something's not right with me.
It wasn't just in your dreams, though, Francisco, because you write that your mother thought that the Border Patrol was an oppressive type of agency. You reassured her. You told her that you wouldn't forget where you were from, that you grew up bussing dishes with migrants in restaurants near the border, and that you wouldn't lose sight of that. In the end, did that work out the way you promised?
Well, I think there was a lot of naivete behind that argument that I made to my mother. And, you know, after joining the Border Patrol, you know, my mother was always there kind of holding me accountable, reminding me of those reasons I had given to her, right? Reminding me of who I was before I joined the Border Patrol, and asking me, you know, have you lost sight of that person? You know, looking back on it, you know, those dreams and my mother, those were sort of the only tether that I had to who I was before the patrol, or to who I was outside of the Border Patrol. So I'm not entirely sure that, you know, without my mother, that I would have come back from that in the same way.
Where do you think this debate is headed in America? I know you watched the big speeches and the debates. You spent some years of your life on the ground, on the border, where immigration is a real part of life. Where do you think this goes in America?
I guess what I would say to that is that I hear these words like, you know, we have to show empathy to the people that are crossing the border. We have to have compassion for, you know, people like the Dreamers. And I've been thinking a lot about that lately because I think that we often sort of pat ourselves on the back just for feeling empathy or compassion for someone. And then we sort of feel like that's enough, like our work is done, like we're a good person. But especially with regard to migrants, you know, with people who risk their lives on a daily basis to cross our border, or who are here and are living in constant fear of deportation, I don't think that empathy or compassion really goes far enough. So, you know, I've become interested in what comes next. You know, how do we move beyond empathy and compassion, and how do we translate that into action?
The book is The Line Becomes a River, a memoir of a Border Patrol agent along the southern border of the United States. Francisco Cantu is the author. It's been great to have you.
Thank you so much.
There's a new international front in the 7-year-old civil war in Syria. And there are a lot of players here, and it can be really confusing to follow who's on what side of this war. You have Russia and Iran, who are key backers of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. You have Gulf Arab states and Turks trying to help the rebels. Today, after 7 bloody years, the Assad regime has firm control over most of Syria, except in the northeast, which is up for grabs. And that's where we're going to put our focus today with the help of Jamal El-Shayal. He's a correspondent for Al Jazeera. He joined us from a cafe on the ground in Gaziantep along the Turkey-Syria border, and he's going to walk us through this extremely complicated picture.
The Turks, together with their proxy or their allies on the ground, the Free Syrian Army, are pushing towards the city of Afrin, which is in the Idlib province. And the reason why Turkey is so concerned about the situation in Syria is not just because it hosts close to 3 million Syrian refugees inside Turkey, but because there is a Kurdish militia group inside Syria, which has connections to another Kurdish militia group inside Turkey, which Ankara considers to be a terrorist organization. The group inside Syria is called the YPG. They're linked to a group called the PKK inside Turkey.
So Turkey's interest here is to fight the Kurdish force in Syria, the YPG, which is linked to the Kurdish forces in Turkey known as the PKK, that it considers a terrorist group. And it's important to note here, the United States also considers the PKK to be a terrorist group. And so you might think that the United States would be fighting alongside Turkey since they both consider PKK a terrorist group, right?
This is where it kind of is a bit tricky, is their sister branch, the YPG in Syria, is actually an ally of the United States. So the U.S. has been sending weapons as well as technical support to the YPG. In fact, in the past 24 hours, the International Anti-ISIS Coalition, headed by the U.S., conducted airstrikes which killed around 100 pro-Assad fighters who were en route to attack the YPG. So essentially, the U.S. has thrown a lot of its weight behind this Kurdish militia inside Syria. It's something that the Turks have been very agitated and angry about because the YPG have been actually launching rockets on Turkish soil, which have so far killed 7 Turkish citizens in the past week or so.
And then you have another player, fighters from the Free Syrian Army. Those are rebels fighting against the Assad regime. Now, they have also joined the fight alongside Turkey against those Kurdish YPG forces. Again, the United States backs the Free Syrian Army. They've even trained those fighters. And the U.S. also backs the Kurds, a key ally in the region. U.S.-backed forces fighting U.S.-backed forces. Jamal El-Shayal, what's in it here for the Free Syrian Army?
One of the main cause behind it is that these fighters have been fighting for freedom since the revolution began, and the YPG has actually been in cahoots with the Assad regime. So they have a common enemy with the Turks, which is the Kurdish fighters. The Free Syrian Army don't like the Kurdish fighters because the Kurdish fighters have been on the side of Damascus from the beginning, but also because they've accused the Kurdish militia of actually carrying out similar practices as ISIS have, in that they've tried to ethnically cleanse the Arab population of certain parts of northern Syria, in that they've conducted extrajudicial killings in terms of publicly executing Arabs in the middle of the street and other ghastly practices. But added to that, obviously, the FSA owes a lot of its weaponry and its capability to the Turks, who have supported it or at least have allowed for reinforcements to go through Turkey to them. So strategically speaking, they're allied in the sense that their existence is very much owed to the Turkish government and the Turkish military.
This now seems to be a battle between two sides, both trained, both funded by the U.S.
What appears to be the case is the U.S. has lacked clarity in its Syria strategy, not just right now in terms of the Trump administration, but even during the Obama administration, where initially there was very clear messages sent by Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, that Assad must go.
The world will not waver. Assad must go, and the Syrian people must be free to choose their own path forward.
Then there was the red line that was decided by the Obama administration of the use of chemical weapons.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized.
And once that red line was crossed, still there was no military intervention. The FSA feels that the U.S.'s support has been very limited and maybe more so of a token gesture than one of commitment to supporting a group which believes it is struggling for freedom. The support that's been handed to the Kurdish militia, however, has been a lot more extensive, a lot more significant, not only in terms of weaponry, but also training. But maybe what's more important here as well is, as you mentioned, the conflict now essentially that seems to be unraveling between two major NATO allies. In fact, they are the largest two militaries inside NATO, that is the U.S. Army and the Turkish Army. You have, on the one hand, the U.S. Army supporting the Kurdish fighters, and on the other hand, the Turks essentially actively battling them out, seeing them as a threat to their national security. And that's why General McMaster actually is headed to Ankara in the next 48 hours, followed by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who's due to be in Ankara on the 14th and the 15th of this month as well, so late next week. Because unless these politicians can actually find a way to agree on what parts of Syria they will be involved in, who to support, who not to support, like I say, you could be staring down a scenario where you have NATO's two biggest members essentially fighting each other either indirectly through proxies or, God forbid, even directly through their military personnel who are present on the ground inside Syria.
Jamal, what about further south in the country? There are reports of chemical weapons on the scene again being used by Bashar al-Assad. What's his status now?
Well, I mean, the most outrageous thing is the use of chemical weapons. And there's been no preventative measure taken to ensure that they are not used again. Obviously, partially because the Russians have been using the veto in the Security Council, but also because the U.S. has been incapable of putting its money where its mouth is in terms of when it decided that chemical weapons was a red line, but that red line was crossed so many times, people assumed that maybe the U.S.'s authority in terms of the international community and its standing was heavily dented because it was unable to back up its threats with regards to the use of those chemical weapons and ensuring the protection of civilians.
Jamal El-Shayal, correspondent for Al Jazeera along the border between Turkey and Syria. Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kenya is in turmoil after three of the country's biggest TV stations were shut down by the government. President Uhuru Kenyatta's government closed the TV stations last week to keep them from broadcasting live coverage of a mock inauguration ceremony in Nairobi, where opposition leader Raila Odinga declared himself the people's president. TV stations remain shut down for days afterward. One of them is still closed. Wairimu Gitahi is founder of Media 20 Productions. She's been following all of these developments from Nairobi.
This issue of switching off the three main television stations ended up being a court case. So at last, the court declared that these TV stations need to be switched back on. It is not very clear why two of them are back on and the other one is not. It's called Citizen TV. But there are speculations that the government was not very happy because this particular TV station went to seek for an injunction when they were switched off, and the government did not take that very kindly. So some people see it as a punishment from the government still. And also the government is, of course, disobeying the court because the court had declared that they be switched back on.
There was an arrest as well, Wairimu. A politician and activist named Miguna Miguna was arrested by the government for appearing at that rally with Raila Odinga. What's the latest with him?
Just as a little bit of a background, there has been all these arrests that the government has been issuing arrest warrants for politicians, opposition politicians who participated in the quote-unquote swearing in of Raila Odinga. So Miguna Miguna is one of them. He's also a very well-known lawyer here. So he's also a Canadian citizen. So the government on Tuesday evening deported him back. They say that when he took the Canadian citizen, he denounced his Kenyan citizenship. Some people see it as not constitutional because by birthright he's Kenyan. But there have been many arrests of people who are allied to the opposition and who participated in the swearing in.
Well, Wairimu, the courts ordered these TV stations back on. The government has refused. You mentioned it. Is this a crisis? How have Kenyans been responding to this censorship?
People have different opinions. There are people who felt that it was okay for the government to switch them off during the live swearing-in ceremony, when the ceremony was going on. But now they feel that the government has taken too long or took too long to accept to switch them back on. And this is starting to be seen as infringement on media freedom. And also the TV stations themselves are quite complaining because, of course, they are private organizations, companies, and therefore they're losing out on revenue. But the whole thing of media freedom is the one that is really a big debate here on is the government acting as dictatorial or not.
Well, Kenya is considered one of the more stable democracies in Africa. Is there any concern here that conditions could be deteriorating or destabilizing?
Yeah, there are concerns that it's reminiscent of the times when we were being ruled by this dictator called Mr. Daniel Arap Moi. So many people are saying, have we gone back to that era?
Well, the head of the government is President Uhuru Kenyatta. What has he said?
He hasn't spoken himself. He's just speaking through, let's say, the Interior Ministry or the Internal Security Minister, Cabinet Secretary, because he's the one who's giving most of the orders. So he hasn't spoken himself directly. But in the sense of the government speaking, for example, through the Interior Security Cabinet Secretary, he's saying that they are doing all these things because these people are associated with an act that is seen as treason by the government. So they are saying they're taking measures against, you know, possible chaos in the country.
Wairimu Gitahi, founder of Media 20 Productions, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We stay in Kenya now, where this weekend, an investigator known for exposing the ivory and rhino horn trade was killed at his home in Nairobi. Esmond Bradley Martin has been called a pioneer in his field, exposing demand and prices in the illegal wildlife trade. His work helped pressure China to outlaw the rhino horn trade in 1993 and to shut down its illegal ivory trade just last month. Martin moved from the United States to Africa in the 1970s. His death is a blow to the wildlife conservation community. Dr. Paula Kahumbu is an ecologist and CEO of the elephant protection group Wildlife Direct. She knew Esmond Martin, and she joins me now from Nairobi. Dr. Kahumbu, welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Esmond Bradley Martin was found stabbed in his home. What do you and your colleagues know about his death? And I wonder if you suspect if it was connected to his work against the ivory trade and poaching?
The only thing that we know is what the police have reported, that he was found dead in his home by his wife on Sunday afternoon at about 5 o'clock. He had just come back from a lunch with a group of conservationists inside Nairobi National Park, and they have not revealed any other details. So do I think it's related to his work? I don't think so. I'm not aware of any threats that have ever been made against him. And I don't have any recollection of him ever expressing fear for his life.
Well, let's talk about that life. Tell me about Esmond Bradley Martin and how he made an impact on the illegal wildlife trade.
Esmond is an American citizen. He moved to Kenya more than 40 years ago, and he studied, he read widely, and he chose to put his time towards understanding the illegal rhino horn trade at first and later on the ivory trade. Almost all of his research was outside of Kenya. And he basically would go into areas and talk to people and record evidence of ivory trade. He would record the presence of items in shops, their prices, the types of items. He would talk to government officials, go into factories, and observe what was happening in those places.
How did all this work, all of this recording, all of this research on the ivory trade work to put pressure on governments, on regulators, police, to shut down ivory markets in places like China and elsewhere?
Some of the most important work that he did was in China, because the Chinese government had been denying that illegal ivory was appearing in their factories or in their retail stores. So Esmond's work basically revealed that the price of ivory was rising very rapidly, considering the small amount of ivory that went into China in 2008. And not only was the price of ivory increasing, but the volume of ivory was far too great to reflect the amount of ivory that China had bought. That, I think, began to put pressure on the Chinese authorities to look into it themselves. For the longest time, they just denied it, and they said it was the ivory that they had bought. And I think Esmond's most recent work revealed that China was playing an unprecedented role in the slaughter of elephants across Africa. And eventually they did back down, acknowledged they had a problem. They tried to put in place more stringent measures, you know, better enforcement or more active work on arresting people and prosecuting them. But I think it was very clear. China is such a large country. It's almost impossible to track down all the people who are trading illegally. The fact that even one shop is open selling ivory means that ivory can be laundered into that shop without buyers knowing whether what they're buying is legal or illegal ivory.
Well, Dr. Kahumbu, poaching and illegal ivory sales continue, but there have been significant crackdowns, as you mentioned, in China and other places. What's Esmond Martin's legacy?
One of the things that Esmond proved was that legal market of ivory in China were actually the places where illegal ivory were being laundered. And in a way, his legacy will be a conclusion that trade in an endangered species is extremely dangerous, because there is nothing that you can do to stop those markets. Once you open them up, it's almost like a free fall.
Dr. Paula Kahumbu with Wildlife Direct on the death of her friend, Esmond Bradley Martin. Dr. Kahumbu, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
There are 1,344 active toxic sites across America, slated for cleanup as part of the Superfund program. And many of these sites have been awaiting cleanup for decades. Well, just last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced the cleanup of one of the sites, a radioactive legacy from the dawn of the Cold War. The Westlake Landfill, northwest of St. Louis, is contaminated with nuclear waste born from the Manhattan Project and the development of the first nuclear weapons.
Westlake is a ticking time bomb.
We are sick. Our kids are sick and we're dying.
Our eyes burn when we walk outside.
There's going to be a disaster.
You know, I don't know what I'm afraid of anymore. They've destroyed my quality of life.
This is what we've been dealing with. We know there's something in that dirt.
Those are some of the angry voices today of residents who've been living for years near the Westlake landfill. Westlake is one of 21 Superfund sites targeted for what the EPA calls immediate and intense action. It's part of a new focus on Superfund sites from EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. Here he was on Fox Business over the weekend.
The agency the last several years has used regulatory power to weaponize against certain sectors of our economy, as opposed to doing things like this, cleaning up a Superfund site in St. Louis, Missouri, taking 27 years to get it done and providing certainty and confidence to the people in that area. So we're getting back to the basics, the core mission of the agency, protecting the health and the environment of our citizens and not allowing the agency to be used in a weaponized way to impact parts of our economy.
That's Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA there. Well, I invited Kara Cook-Schultz to put all of this into context for us. She's the toxics director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, and I asked Kara why this site near St. Louis has been so polluted for so long.
Well, the simple answer for why it's been contaminated for so long is that it's actually a radioactive site. Believe it or not, portions of the Manhattan Project are actually at this site and were illegally dumped there decades ago. So various agencies have been involved over the years, as you can imagine, because of the complexity of dealing with radioactive waste.
And what's EPA proposing to do now to finally get this legacy Manhattan Project site cleaned up?
The EPA is proposing something they're calling Excavation Plus, which is a fancy way of saying they're going to remove about 70% of the radioactive waste and soil from the site, and they're going to leave the rest underground.
Buried underground where ostensibly it'll be safe for people around the site?
Scientists at the EPA have suggested that it would be safe if it is underground. They're saying they're going to excavate 16 feet of this radioactive waste, and the rest of it's going to be pretty far underground. What you have to realize about the site, though, is that it's really close to the Missouri River, and it's actually in the floodplain of the Missouri River. So when you say 16 feet underground, you have to remember that water doesn't think the way that we think, and water actually flows underneath the ground in those floodplains. So the concern for community members, environmental scientists, and other people in the area is that even though it's far underground, it's not actually away from possible contamination.
And do researchers, scientists, water experts in the area, Kara, already, are they confident that radioactive waste hasn't leached from this site into the Missouri River already?
No, scientists are not confident about that. It is a possibility that low levels of radioactive waste has been leaching from the site over the decades. But really, the biggest concern right now, and the thing that the EPA and the state of Missouri are very worried about, is there's actually an ongoing fire occurring underground only 600 feet away from the site, which is kind of mind-boggling and should give you a sense of how complex and risky the site is.
Yeah, a complicated cleanup for a very contaminated site. Well, Kerry, Scott Pruitt is focused on 21 sites for cleanup as part of this sort of new push for Superfund. Why these 21 when there are 1,300 sites across the country?
Scott Pruitt convened a task force over the summer that is looking at what they would call the worst sites, the sites that are most in need of cleanup, most dangerous, closest to big populated areas. And those are the sites that they have decided they want to clean up right now, which is good. These sites need to be cleaned up. I want to be clear about that. The concern for me is that there are 1,300 sites across the country that need this cleanup, all of which are unbelievably hazardous. And to say that let's just do 21, I think can be dangerous. From my perspective, what we need to be saying is, how can we get the funds, how can we get the resources to clean up all of these hazardous waste sites?
You know, the environmental community, Kara, and I know you know this because you're part of it, they've had a lot of criticism for Scott Pruitt for how he's running the EPA, suspending rules, eliminating offices, de-emphasizing clean air, clean water regulation, pulling back on climate rules. This is one area, or so it seems, where Administrator Scott Pruitt seems to be in favor of strong government action. Do you see it that way, and why here?
I do think that Scott Pruitt is serious that he wants to clean up these 21 sites. He said it's a main priority. He's put his money where his mouth is. He really did convene this task force. But from my perspective and the perspective of his critics, the problem with only concentrating on this one aspect of toxic and hazardous waste is that we're not actually doing anything to long-term clean up and solve these problems. And what I mean by that is, at the same time that he's saying he's going to clean up these 21 sites, he's also saying that we should cut funding for the program, the Superfund program, which is actually the program that will clean up these sites. He wants to cut funding for the Superfund program by 30%. Not only that, but he is not taking any action to prevent future Superfund sites. So just this last week, there was hearings on something called the Integrated Risk Information Systems, which you can call IRIS for short. The reason that that's an important system is it's a part of the EPA that actually evaluates the risk of future sites and that it actually evaluates the risk of future chemical contamination. And Scott Pruitt is talking about completely getting rid of this system and of getting rid of the independent scientists. So it's important to clean up these sites, but it's even more important to prevent future sites from happening. It's even more important to say, where are we going to get the funding to clean up all of the sites that are currently out there, not just 21 sites out of 1,300.
Well, Administrator Scott Pruitt has also proposed this month getting rid of the Chemical Safety Board. They investigate industrial accidents. What does that say to you about EPA's overall priorities when it comes to industry and pollution and cleanup?
What it says to me is that Scott Pruitt is willing to clean up sites that have a lot of community pressure behind them, but he's willing to bow to industry pressure when it comes to preventing future accidents. And that's absurd. We should be preventing these horrible sites from occurring. Without something like the Chemical Safety Board, we can't ensure that industry is following all of the safety rules that we desperately need. You know, one example from my home state of Texas, just 4 years ago, there was a horrible chemical explosion. Over a dozen people died in West Texas. And those explosions and those chemical accidents are the kinds of things we need to be preventing.
Kara Cook-Schultz, Toxics Director for U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Kara, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Violent crime is down across America. In fact, most crime is. There may be less crime on the streets, but in cyberspace, it's on the rise. Law enforcement has a tough time policing crimes in cyberspace. Criminals can be across the world when they choose victims. But that's only one part of the problem. Only about 12% of all cybercrime perpetrated on Americans ever gets reported to authorities, according to one recent estimate in the New York Times. Authorities barely track those crimes to even know how big the problem is. And the result is an online world where criminals can prey on victims remotely and know that they probably won't ever be chased, let alone caught. Dr. Gregory Michalides is a cybersecurity communications consultant and a former public affairs staffer in the Department of Homeland Security in the Obama administration.
Cybercrime, in a lot of ways, looks like crimes that we're used to. I think what we're seeing, however, is that cyberspace and digital networks and social media has a lot of positive aspects that can really empower us, but it also empowers the bad guys. And unlike us, the bad guys don't try to follow the rules. And so they look for gaps and they look for ways to exploit these systems that we're all dependent on now. And I think that law enforcement and all of us are playing catch up, trying to understand what it is that's going on in terms of the crimes that we're seeing.
Well, the police are playing catch up, but the internet's not totally new anymore. Are police with guns and squad cars just still totally unequipped to deal with cybercrime?
I don't think that this is really a critique of law enforcement in and of itself. I think we have a lot of very able and capable people in law enforcement, and I worked with many of them when I was at DHS. I think one problem is that the systems that we have in place to count and gather information about the types of so-called digital crimes, and here we could be talking about anything from identity theft to child exploitation, online bullying. We're seeing increases in things like ransomware, but even things extending to drug trafficking and human trafficking. The data collection systems that we have right now are just not up to the task.
Well, you mentioned the difficulty in even getting a handle on the scope of cybercrime, even tracking it. I mean, the police have to know how big the problem is before they can get their arms around it. And we heard that disturbing statistic just a minute ago. Only 12% of crimes in cyberspace are actually reported to authorities. It's astoundingly low.
It is. And we know that, you know, only a percentage of property crimes, even violent crimes, get reported to the police. And we're also seeing some of the problems with, you know, there's essentially a voluntary system of reporting where state and local law enforcement send in either aggregated data or they send in incident data to, you know, to the FBI and to the Department of Justice. But again, many people underreport or don't report those types of crimes, in part perhaps from a sense of shame or embarrassment, in part because they may not perceive really that they were the victim of a, quote, cybercrime. And they may see it as something a little bit different or a little more routine, things like bullying or extortion or theft. And we don't have the correct categories, I think, in terms of data collection. But I think that even in our own heads, we haven't come around to what these things really are.
Gregory, it's understandable that these crimes are difficult to record and coordinate. Most people don't report if they are the victims of cybercrime. So this isn't easy on the police. But it sounds like they're moving pretty slowly. And that sounds like it leads to kind of a wild west of cybercrime. If the police move slowly and victims don't report, don't cyber criminals know that they can essentially perpetrate crimes and have a very low percentage of somebody even coming after them, much less catching them?
I think it's true that very few of them at the moment do get caught and do get prosecuted. And certainly there's a role for smarter, more effective law enforcement here as well. But I step back from it a little bit and I place some of the blame on all of us, essentially, as a society, and especially within our schools and our institutions. We don't do a very good job of talking with young people about both the opportunities and the perils and the drawbacks of technology. Right now, a lot of the education and efforts to instruct young people on how to kind of be a healthy, safe online citizen are haphazard and often industry funded efforts. And the model that we're using right here is really one of sharing and openness, not one of smart, common sense security settings and skepticism towards some of the promises of the technology company. So I think that there's more than enough blame, and certainly not all at the feet of law enforcement.
Well, what's it going to take then, Gregory, to change the street smarts of people on the internet? And what will it take to change some of the incentives of cybercrime? We described a world where criminals know they probably won't be chased. They almost certainly won't be caught. And their incentives are pretty clear right now.
I think to really change this, that we need to take a fresh look at how we talk about and educate young people and, you know, new employees to companies about data protection and information and privacy, and approach this much more like a public health and safety issue. You mentioned street smart. And so when you're a little kid, you learn about stopping at the stop sign and looking both ways. You know, we take common sense measures in our homes. We know we can't have perfect protection, but we leave a light on and we lock the doors. We are not learning and doing those kinds of things right now as a society when it comes to technology, even though a lot of the risks are the same as they are out in the real world.
Dr. Gregory Michalaitis, former public affairs staffer in the Department of Homeland Security and a cybersecurity consultant. Greg, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to leave you today with a little bit of history made on the House floor yesterday by Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi.
Mr. Speaker, this debate is an utter waste of time. Every day, courageous, patriotic dreamers lose their status. Every day, the American dream slips further out of reach. As members of Congress, we have a moral responsibility to act now to protect dreamers who are the pride of our nation and are American in every way, but on paper.
That's just one small slice of a speech that Nancy Pelosi delivered yesterday, demanding a deal on DACA. Now, the House doesn't have filibusters, but Pelosi used her leader prerogative, stood up to talk about DACA, and didn't stop for 8 hours. Ciriaque Alvarez is an immigration rights activist and a DACA recipient herself, and she watched parts of the marathon speech yesterday.
The longer she stood there and the longer that she shared stories, it was really empowering, just because it was once again brought into the light, not just about we need to do this, it's we need to do this now. And I don't know if you saw the hashtag, like the Go Nancy Go on Twitter. I saw a couple of my friends post about it, and just hoping that this isn't just a speech, but is a conversation that she's having with the Republican Party and with other Democrats, just other legislators.
Well, it was the longest speech ever on the House floor, but about that conversation with Republicans and Democrats that Ciriaque Alvarez mentioned. Why all the showy effort from Nancy Pelosi? Well, here's the thing. She's in a bind, and some of Ciriaque's allies might not like where this is headed. The House and Senate just agreed on a big two-year spending deal, and it has $131 billion in new domestic programs that Democrats have been desperate for years, things like NIH, SCHIP, other programs. And here's the problem. The Senate made a spending deal, but that deal was House Democrats' best leverage to try to get a deal on DACA. And now Nancy Pelosi is desperate to show that DACA is still a priority. Did she succeed? Congress now has less than a month to come up with a deal before the DACA deadline expires. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom.com, providing public radio listeners with legal advice and guidance on business matters and estate plans through its network of independent attorneys. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/takeaway by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. By Progressive Insurance, with the Name Your Price tool, providing information on a range of insurance coverage and price options. More at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's Progressive. And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.